Welcome back to today's Topical Currents. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Bonnie Berman. Joseph Cooper is still recovering from a severe back injury. He is doing much better, and we hope to have him back with us very soon. Well, today we look at what our guest calls the glorious mess known as the English language through an historical lens. Many of the words decried by today's purists as incorrect had another meaning in centuries past, and ironically, they'd be used correctly today. Let's weave our way through the entertaining history of language mistakes with Ammon Shea. He's the author of Reading the OED, One Man, One Year, 21,730 pages, among other books, an editor, book reviewer, and a contributor to the On Language column in Sunday's New York Times. And Ammon Shea joins us from NPR in New York City. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure to have you with us. So let me ask you, every day, Ammon, my colleagues at work ask me about Joe Cooper, who's the creator and co-host on this program and who I mentioned has been out for a long time. And invariably, all these well-meaning people conclude our exchanges with the words, hopefully Joe's doing better, or hopefully he'll be back soon. Mm-hmm. So let's start there. Tell us about hopefully, and you tell me.
Well, hopefully is one of those words that provides many people with a warm blanket of contempt because they are under the impression that other people are frequently misusing it. And the sense in which people feel it is being misused is kind of as what you would call a sentence adverb, which is an adverb which modifies the whole sentence. And you are saying, hopefully, this thing will happen. In the minds of some purists, what you should be saying is essentially, it is to be hoped that this will happen. And if you say hopefully, what you are only saying is that something is actually happening in a hopeful manner. And so there are a lot of ways, if you follow this rule, in which hopefully can go wrong. For instance, you say, hopefully the book will arrive tomorrow, and then people say, aha, but you know, a book cannot actually feel hope, so that doesn't make any sense. Even though I suspect strongly that they actually know what you are talking about. This mistaken or ostensibly mistaken sense of hopefully, it's been in use for a little while, since about 1648. So it's been theoretically misused for well over 350 years now. And it started to get a measure of acceptance in 2012. The Associated Press, of all things, issued a tweet saying, we now support the modern use of hopefully, and this upset many people. But by and large, the word is more often used in a sentence adverb sense, as in, hopefully, Cooper will be better soon. But the rule against using it in this fashion still has a large number of disgruntled adherents.
So would you say you're more interested in the annoyances of these language police, we'll call them, by what they think is wrong than what is actually right or wrong?
Yeah, I think that it's very difficult to say that something or most of these things are actually right or wrong, considering that so many of them have changed over the years. So what I'm interested in is why we think these things are wrong. To me, it's really not enough to simply say that's wrong or that's right. I think what we need to do is look at why it is considered so. You know, a lot of people hold on to the distinction between disinterested and uninterested. And to these people, disinterested should only be applied to, say, a judge, somebody who is impartial, and uninterested should only mean lacking interest or bored. So, for instance, you want a disinterested judge and you probably end up with uninterested teenagers as children. It's a fine distinction to make, except that it overlooks the fact that when the words first entered the language, they actually meant the opposite. So in the first use of disinterested, it meant bored and uninterested, as we think of it today, and vice versa for uninterested. So words change meaning all the time. It's really one of the inevitable aspects of any language. And it's a sign of a healthy language that words change meaning. Dead languages do not change meaning very often.
Like Latin.
Right. You notice you don't see a lot of people arguing about the correct meaning of certain Latin words because, quite frankly, very few of us care outside of the Vatican.
So it's not the English language that's ever changing so much. It's not that the English language is unique. It's that most languages experience similar changes, would you say?
Right. I'd say all languages change as long as they're healthy. And there is one surefire way to make sure that a language does not change anymore, and that is to kill everybody who speaks that language. That is pretty much the only way you can ensure that a word a language will keep all of its meanings.
So when I say I really enjoyed reading your very unique book, and your erudition and humor literally blew me away.
Right. You will annoy a lot of people.
Well, let's talk about that literally versus figuratively. Give us a little history.
Okay. Again, to the people who are purists in this regard, literally means one thing. It means in a literal fashion. That's all well and good as long as we can agree on what literal actually means. And it's not certain what literal means because it does have a variety of meanings. And the meaning that people hope or would like it to have is exactly as it seems, or in a very literal fashion, in a specific, exact fashion. Unfortunately, that has not always been the meaning of literal. When it first entered the English language, in I think the 16th century, it meant letter for letter, and it was a literary term referring to copying text letter by letter, or referred just literal of or relating to letters. That was the really original meaning, and then it's changed, and it took up the meanings, maybe 50 or 100 years after, of meaning without any metaphor, which is the way that people really like it now. But people have been using it in what we think of as a figurative fashion for well over 150, almost 200 years now, including a lot of the giants of English literature. Mark Twain and Tom Sawyer, in that great scene where Tom bamboozles a bunch of the neighborhood boys into helping him whitewash a fence, and they give him, prizes and loot in exchange for performing this task. At the end of it, Twain writes, "Tom was literally rolling in wealth." We don't have any actual indication that Tom was rolling around physically. It's an expression. Likewise, Vladimir Nabokov in Invitation to a Beheading uses the line, "And with his eyes, he literally scoured the corners of his cell." There's no indication that Nabokov means the protagonist removes his eyes from his head and scrubs the walls of his cell with them. But somehow we actually seem to know what he means. It does still annoy a lot of people, and it's because they think, I imagine, it's because the feeling is that some kind of specificity of meaning is lost. And I don't think that's the case. I think that we can understand within the context in which somebody is trying to communicate to us what it is that they mean.
So, go ahead.
But the other word that you used was very unique, which
yes.
is one that really rubs people the wrong way. And it's a wonderful example of how not only does language change, but the rules governing language change. And unique, first of all, when it first entered the English language in, I think, the 16th century, it comes from the Latin word unicus, meaning one of its kind or single of its kind. And that's the meaning that people have always hoped that it would hold on to. But for the first about 200 years that unique was in use in English, most language commentators, when they paid attention to it at all, weren't saying, well, it should keep this meaning. They were saying it's a silly word. We shouldn't use it at all. Henry Todd, a lexicographer in the 18th century, referred to it as an affected and useless term of modern times. And it was just generally frowned upon. And what happened was that at the end of the 19th century, it kind of gained a measure of acceptance. And as soon as it did, people started using it in a broadened fashion. Charlotte Bronte, Ezra Pound, a lot of people use it in, they use it as more unique or less unique, ways like that. The reason this is a problem is because it's thought to be what we call an absolute adjective. Mm-hmm. And an absolute adjective is a word that permits no variation in state. You are either unique or not. It's kind of like the word is pregnant or it's not pregnant. That's the view. Unfortunately, unique is not the only absolute adjective we have had in English. And in the 19th century, grammarians used to make lists of other words that are absolute, that cannot be modified. So if you want to hold on to unique as an unmodifiable word, I think it's fine. But I think if you want to then be consistent, you should have the same standards for words like dry, wet, straight, flat, equal, clear, evident, correct, quiet, true, empty, full, just, unjust, all of which are part of a list of dozens, if not hundreds, of other words that at one point in time have been thought to be absolute. I mean, perfect is a great example. Something is either perfect or it is not perfect. But you rarely hear people complain about the opening line to the preamble of the United States Constitution, which speaks about, we the people, in order to create a more perfect union, which is misusing the word the same way that we see people misuse unique today.
We are speaking with Ammon Shay, and we're talking about the English language and words and how they came to be and how they've changed over time. He's written several books, reading the OED, but his latest book, Bad English, A History of Linguistic Aggravation, which I think I forgot to announce at the very beginning, that is the book, Bad English, A History of Linguistic Aggravation. We're going to take a short break on today's topical currents, and we're going to come back and ask you about your linguistic pet peeves. So stay with us. Welcome back to today's Topical Currents. Bonnie Berman visiting with Ammon Shay. And his latest book is Bad English, A History of Linguistic Aggravation. As promised, we'd like to hear about your linguistic pet peeves, which words, phrases, or usages infuriate you. And do you think English is being degraded with electronic communications? Well, irregardless of what you think you know about our language, you can join us at 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-9576, or you can email us at radio@wlrn.org. I can't even use irregardless with a straight face, but so let's look at some of the words that are not words from that chapter of your book, such as irregardless. Why was the meaningless prefix added in the first place, and why is it so irritating?
We don't exactly know why the meaningless IR was added to the noble word, regardless. There's some speculation that it's because the prefix IR is thought to give a sense of emphasis to certain words, and so that's why it came about. It's not, irregardless is not unique in the way that it was formed. I mean, we do have other words in English which do have seemingly meaningless prefixes. For instance, valuable and invaluable are very, very closely related in meaning, and so are habitable and inhabitable. These words really mean pretty much the same thing in most contexts, and you could say, well, we don't need that extra prefix. For some reason, they've gotten kind of smoothed down around the edges, and people rarely, if ever, complain about them. Irregardless has really kept the power to annoy for an astonishingly long period of time. It's a little bit older than most people tend to think. I mean, the first use that I've ever seen of it was in 1795 in the Charleston City Gazette in a rather poorly written poem. And it's been around at least, you know, since the end of the 18th century and probably was in use vocally before that. So I'm not sure why it was formed, and I'm also not entirely sure why it bothers so many people. I mean, it is a word that is formed essentially by mistake. But there are plenty of words that have been formed by mistake. For instance, the word fruition initially had absolutely nothing to do with fruit or ripening or coming to pass. And then somebody along the way saw the word fruit in the word fruition and thought, well, if fruit is in there, it obviously must mean ripening in some sense or changing. And so that meaning was kind of tacked on. And now when you say our plans are coming to fruition, most people don't say, well, that word was formed incorrectly, therefore you're wrong. It's just something that has now entered the language, and we don't really think much of it anymore.
Well, what about some of these other words like belittle, which I think you said was coined by Thomas Jefferson? What's
yes,
wrong
it
with
is.
That?
I think that had more of a political bent the complaints about that, and it was also the fact that this was used first by Thomas Jefferson in I think 1782 in his book Notes on the State of Virginia, and of course this is shortly after the United States Revolution, and the British have always been a little bit touchy on the subject of language and how Americans use language, and they're very fond of saying that Americans are doing unseemly things to the English language. In most cases, when you see a British commentator on language complaining about American language use, in most cases, the British have done it first. But in this case, they obviously weren't that fond of Thomas Jefferson for a number of reasons. And so when he used this word, the London Review wrote, "We will forgive all your attacks, impotent as they are illiberal upon our national character, but for the future, spare, oh, spare, we beseech you, our mother tongue." A little bit over-the-top reaction.
Little.
Right, and it was just thought to be a nonsense word, and of course, it's what's interesting about that is that it's as late as 1926, I think it was, Henry Fowler, writing in the Dictionary of Modern English Usage, was still referring to belittle as an undesirable alien in the English language. So you can just look back, you know, less than 100 years ago, we see that words which are entirely normal to us today really were broadly frowned upon.
I'm amazed by how much you know and remember. I mean, is this from reading the OED?
No, it's not. It's just certain things I have a habit of sticking in my brain.
Okay, well, we have lots of calls, and we have lots of emails, but this is Harold. He says, please explain the different use of adjectives and adverbs in conjunction with sense verbs. If you've not bathed for a week, you smell bad. If your nose is clogged up, you smell badly. If you burn your fingertips, you feel badly. If you still have that cold, you feel bad. When you tour Europe by boat, you see things different. When you have a robotic eye, you see things differently.
Yeah, badly is an interesting one that still confuses and also irritates a lot of people. Mm-hmm. It's often thought to be, I think, a kind of a hypercorrection. People think, well, you know, you have an impulse to say, I felt badly when something happened. And I think the reason is it's kind of along the lines of a hypercorrection, which is that people oftentimes will kind of default to what seems to be a more prestigious use of a word. And so badly, they just think, sounds better. It's kind of like the thing of, you know, using myself rather than me.
Oh, that's one of mine. What is that?
Right. Well, people think that it sounds better. So that, you know, a lot of times, I think as simple a notion as the longer word is the better word. So many people, including there's a famous case where Donald Trump on national television corrected Cyndi Lauper in an episode of The Apprentice when she, you know, something they were discussing the show, which I didn't actually see, and she said, I feel bad. And he said, no, you don't feel bad, you feel badly. And if I could interject an editorial aside for a moment, I think if anybody knows how to feel badly, it is probably Donald Trump, and I mean in the literal sense of the word. In a strictly prescriptive view of English grammar, to say I feel badly would mean that I am actually incapable of feeling as a normal human being, which is why I'm attributing this to Mr. Trump.
Yes.
Whether he does feel badly or not, I really don't know, of course. But so it's perfectly acceptable when you feel less than well to say I feel bad. The adverb sense of the word I feel badly would be describing the manner in which you feel. So, for instance, in a very technical sense, if you put thick gloves on and you're trying to read Braille, you would say I feel badly.
Got it. Okay, let's take some calls. I have so many more questions, but we want to go to Andres or Andre in Miami. Hi, Andre.
Hey, how you doing?
How are you?
I'm doing well.
Good.
So... My question, I work in marketing, and usually when we set up mock-ups for websites, we have a copy that is just there for purely for visual, so you can have a visual idea of what is going to be there. And it's turned into this thing where everyone calls that copy verbiage, and every time I look it up, it doesn't mean the word copy. It just means, like, a list of actions. It's not actual content. So is that correct, or is everyone in my organization using this right? Because it's spreading like a cancer.
Well, that is how language spells, spreads generally like a cancer. What it sounds to me, and I'm not an authority on this particular aspect of the language, but it sounds to me that it's essentially a form of jargon that you guys are using. And if a group of people use a word within their field, it has a distinct meaning within that field. And that is oftentimes how words will enter the language. For instance, finalize was a word that spread. It was a jargon word in New Zealand and Australia, I think, in kind of copy. In businessmen in those countries used it that way, and then it spread to the United States and the rest of the world. So words will spread that way, and it may have had another meaning before that. But one of the things about dictionaries is that they tend to reflect as much as they can the way that language is generally used by a broad swath of the educated population. So it will typically take a while before a word is used, you know, as specific jargon within a small field. It'll take a while before it spreads into the rest of the population. However, many words have entered into English after being jargon in you know, copy editing or business writing fields. So it's entirely possible that you will then see it creep into the English language in more accepted use. My feeling is generally if a particular subset of people are using a word to mean something, and if they all understand this is what it means, and they are all using it with the intention of it meaning that, well then, quite honestly, that's what the word means. That is how words take on meanings, is people use them in a specific way. It's a very kind of Alice in Wonderland approach to language, you know, where the Red Queen says, you know, when I use a word to mean this, it means exactly what I intend it to mean. So as far as I'm concerned, it sounds fine to me.
Right, okay, thanks. Andre, thanks for calling. You appear to be very tolerant of all these changes and these shifts, but do you think there are any changes that are bad for the language?
Yeah, I think if it stops changing, that's bad for the language. I think stasis is bad, but it's very difficult to say. No, I don't. Well, actually, it's not difficult to say. I don't think there are any changes that are bad. I think there are changes that sound bad or feel bad. But if you look back 100 years ago, which is a very, very short period of time within the history of language change, it's extremely easy to find words that we wouldn't think twice about today being really people being excoriated for using words. So, for instance, you know, many people find that the use of the word like grates on their ears. I'm sure a number of your listeners dislike hearing kids today using like. It's thought to be meaningless. It's thought to be, you know, superfluous. It's a evidence of a lack of intellect or care.
And they start a sentence with it.
Like, we start a sentence with it, right. Exactly. Except in 1907, I think it was, Ambrose Bierce, the author of The Devil's Dictionary, a kind of wonderful pundit and also writer on language, wrote a very cranky book called Write It Right. And among other things that he had a problem with was he disliked the use of the word well to begin a sentence, and he referred to it as a mere meaningless prelude to a sentence. In other words, people were using well back then, as they use it now, which is to say very similarly to the way that teenagers and 80-year-olds start a sentence with the word like. Now, the only difference between the use of the word like to begin a sentence and the use of the word well to begin a sentence is that your grandparents start their sentences with well and your grandchildren start their sentences with like. But functionally, there is really very, very little difference between these two words in this case. So you would really seem like a bit of an unhinged scold if you were to go around saying to people, I wish you just would stop beginning your sentences with well. It makes you sound like an uneducated fool. Yet we feel entirely comfortable saying this to people when they begin their sentences with like. So I think there's a lack of consistency there. This is just the way that language operates.
Like when? well, when we asked Andre how he was, he said he was well. Well, we have an emailer who says, when people say, this is so me, when they are doing good upon being asked, how are you doing? Almost everyone says this as opposed to saying, I am doing well. I am doing good acceptable?
Well, it is not I am doing good that is generally what people say. If you say, how are you, typically the response is, I'm good or I am good. And the reason that this is generally considered wrong is because good is an adjective and it follows a verb. And in the school that most of us went to, we are taught that an adverb should follow a verb. So well, in this case, would be an adverb. I am well. But there's a wrinkle here, which is that the verb to be, in the case, is an I am is what we refer to as a copulative verb or a linking verb. It's not an active or an action verb. And it's very, it's fine to follow a copulative or a linking verb with an adjective. So there is nothing wrong grammatically with saying I am good. It's just not an actual mistake. The way that this kind of became a problem is that people would frequently, and still do frequently, misuse, or theoretically misuse by grammatical tenets, the adjective good in other very similar cases. So he did it good. In that case, correctly, would be he did it well. But it's very difficult to distinguish between good following an action verb or a copulative verb. It's a kind of a it's not such an obvious point that people typically make the distinction. So many of us have kind of then defaulted to, well, I, followed by a verb, should automatically have an adverb after. And that's not necessarily the case. There's really nothing wrong with I'm good. So another one is, you think of the James Brown song, I Feel Good. Feel is a copulative of our linking verb. It's not, I mean, it can function the same way, I feel good. It's fine to say that. It's fine to say I am good. You could also say I am well, because I think well can function as an adjective or an adverb. But there's nothing wrong inherently with saying I am good.
We have so many members of the language police that are writing in and calling in. Let me just do this one. Ellie, she's lie and lay, grr. And then no one used who anymore. No one uses who, I think she means, anymore. Even on NPR, you hear the people that went or the family that had to flee, not who had to flee. And this was one from your book, which I loved, the misuse of enormity. You know, all in caps, all okay. In caps with exclamation point.
Well, let me address enormity of those four peeves, so they're all fine peeves. Enormity is a wonderful example, and the problem that I assume your writer, your caller, Ellie has with enormity, is that people sometimes use enormity to mean something that is very large, and the quote-unquote proper meaning of enormity is great wickedness. So to say the enormity of the task, as Barack Obama did a few years ago, he's spoke of the enormity of the task facing us. It was about 3 years back. This is seen as what he's actually saying is the great wickedness of the task ahead of us, and that just doesn't make sense. What he's trying to say is the great size. Mm-hmm. And so what many people say is, well, what he should say is the enormousness of the task, because enormousness means great size. All well and good, except for the fact that for the first 200 years that enormousness existed in English, it meant great wickedness. And that was for the entirety of the 17th and 18th century. Enormousness did not actually come to mean great size until the beginning of the 1900s. Similarly, enormous as an adjective referring to something that is large, before it meant that, it meant something that is wicked or profane or hideous. Mm. So it's unclear to me why we should accept that enormousness and enormous can start out meaning one thing, and then because everybody uses it another way, well, it's too late to stop them. We might as well accept it. Why are we okay with that? But for some reason, why would we then, of this trio of enorm words, why would we feel that we have to hold the line on enormity? There's no logical reason except that what we're really saying is, well, it's okay for some words to change, just not the ones that I like. And that's a very difficult position to have. It's fine to say, I think it's still wrong. However, it's difficult to say that it's difficult to stop it, I guess I would say.
Well, Ellie will have to tolerate it, I guess. Okay, let's go to Donald in Hollywood, although Ellie had the lay and lie, too, and she also had the not using who anymore.
Right.
Okay.
Go ahead. We'll move on to another peeve.
Okay, let's move on to Donald in Hollywood. Let's see. Hi, Donald.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. I have two pet peeves. One is the use of twice. For example, the point is that I can't get on the air. Everybody does this. It drives me nuts. President Obama does this frequently, but he's by no means alone. The problem is that whatever. I've actually heard. I remember I was on your program. They had some guests. They were talking about the San Francisco earthquake, and he said the problem is that they couldn't get the fire engines out. You know, using is in the past tense, and it just drives me nuts. It makes no sense, whatever. The other one is so. Actually, Bonnie, you did this right at the beginning of the show. The first thing you said to the professor was, so let me ask you. But I have a variation on the so. What I hear is people say when they answer a question. I heard it last night on television. They were talking about the Senate race in Mississippi. the reporter asked the reporter, what's the news from Mississippi? Or how is the election going? And the answer was, right, so Senator Cochran is leading. How did you get started in show business? Yes, so... when I was 9 years old, this...
Okay, oh, Donald, let's... Let, okay. Let,
let, okay. Let's, I can go let, on.
Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, these are fine peeves to have. And one thing that if you want to feel more comfortable with the way that other people use this, what I would recommend you do sometime is ask a friend of yours to, without your knowledge, record you speaking in a normal conversation. And then sit down and with... brutal honesty, transcribe the things that you yourself have actually said. And I think you will find that there is an excellent chance that you are using some grammatical errors that you frequently find are annoying in other people. And I don't mean this to be cruel to you or to say that you speak improperly, because you don't. You speak very well. However, everybody, when they speak, uses a slightly different register, or in some cases an extremely different register of English than when they write. And so I think you will find there are very few people, educated users of the language, who will do these things. Very few people start a sentence by writing right, comma, so, comma, this is what's happening. It's just obvious that it's not right. It is a vocal tic that many people have. And it is widespread, and that's true, as is the double is. There is frequently no logical reason to have was, is, was, is, etc. However, it's kind of a placeholder word sometimes, and so you'll find it much more frequently in spoken language than in written language. But I think also that if you actually write down your own conversation without knowing that you're being recorded, just writing down a conversation of yours that unbeknownst to you, which is another word that people used to hate, unbeknownst to you was recorded by somebody else, I think it is an excellent chance that you'll find some of these little problems creeping into your own speech patterns as well. There's really very little, I think, that's wrong with them.
Okay. So, Donald, thank you for calling. Okay. Oh, sorry. I'm so sorry. That was involuntary. Okay, but we want to talk to Roger, who talks about a word from your book, Roger in Miami Beach. Hi. Roger? Are you there? Okay. He wanted to talk about the word fun, which is a good one. I know.
Well, we can just mention fun briefly.
Let's talk about fun.
In case he's still listening. The problem that people have with fun sometimes is that fun is thought to not be an adjective. So it would be improper to say that something is fun or we had a fun time. It would be considered equivalent to saying that was so enjoyment, because enjoyment, like fun, is thought to be a noun. So it's considered improper to use fun as an adjective. And fun was initially a noun and a verb in the English language. It entered English in, I think, the middle of the 17th century. And it was kind of a slang term criminals used to describe a hoax or cheating somebody. And then in the middle of the 19th century, it kind of started creeping into adjectivehood, and it did so as what was referred to as an attributive noun. An attributive noun is it's a noun that functions kind of as a verb. For instance, a college student. Well, college is obviously a noun, but we're using it as an adjective here. And then the first case that we have recorded of fun in that sense was somebody referring to the fun room, which is a Victorian thing, which I don't really know what a fun room was, but since it's used in mid-Victorian England, we can probably assume it was, you know, throwing darts at orphans or something like that. Oh, I don't know. With rats involved and terriers. Right. Occasional boot blacks. But so once it started being used as a vaguely adjectival form, then people started using it as an actual adjective. And what's interesting about fun is that you can see how this word is slowly making its word into, you know, how it's slowly changing. But we see kind of great evidence of why it's a very slow process, in that it still sounds odd to most people if they say funner. Well, fun is obviously an adjective, but it's kind of a recent adjective, and we see evidence of this by the fact that some adjectival forms of it still sound, some using it as an incomparative or superlative form. Funnest, that's the funnest thing I ever did. Mm-hmm. It still grates on most people's ears. So while, there's no logical reason if it functions as an adjective why it shouldn't actually take on these comparative and superlative forms, except that it's still kind of new. So that's the problem with fun.
Well, here's what Evan writes. He says, Edwin Newman, who pointed out the uses of hopefully, massive, and other examples, wanted us to consider that imprecise language leads to or is the result of imprecise thought. He says, you guys just last week interviewed two candidates for the Palm Beach School Board, one of whom, apology to Calvin Trillin, used disparaging when he meant disparate. No one even noticed. Okay.
Well, I think the use of disparaging for disparate is... that sounds like a mistake, and our language is full of mistakes, and people have always been using language incorrectly. My feeling is that there is very little chance that disparaging will then catch on. It would take a lot of people to use disparaging to mean disparate.
To mean desperate. Disparate, okay.
Right. You would have to have tens, if not hundreds of thousands of people simultaneously making the same mistake in order for this to get enough of a bench head in the semantic, front to change it. So it's very unlikely that will happen. So these things tend to kind of go it's a messy fashion, but there is a certain logic behind it.
Okay, let's talk to Mary. We have just a short time before our break in Kendall. Hi, Mary.
Afternoon. Hi. Good afternoon. My pet peeve is misplaced modifiers. It's all over, especially the newscasters, both TV and radio. My favorite one of all time was in the Herald, a headline, "Please kill man with machete." I would have thought they would have killed him with a gun. You know what I mean?
Right.
But you hear the newscasters, someone wrote it, and they read it, and it's all wrong. But
yeah.
I don't know if I'm just the only one who worries about is the peeve of this or what.
That is imprecise language, and I can see how that would then be confusing. And one of the reasons I think you see that is news headlines tend to work with a somewhat constrained sort of space. And it is probably clear in the actual text of the article that this was police wielding a machete, right? So we can see why this would happen. However, one of the things that I've noticed is that journalists have been blamed for an enormous number of the ills that have been visited on the language. In some cases, I think it's not really their fault, but with misplaced modifiers in this sense, sure, you can see that would lead to a mistaken meaning. And I think that's fine to have a problem with that. I think that if you understand what somebody is saying, if it's very clear within your particular social linguistic register, if you're talking to people, friends, coworkers, peers of any sort, and it's very clear between you what you're saying, I think that there's nothing wrong with the language being stretched or changed. If it's suddenly unclear, well, then yes, you do in fact have a problem, because obviously the point of language is to communicate some idea or sentiment.
Exactly.
So.
Exactly.
Okay,
Mary. I just wanted to mention, you said the beginning of sentences. I can't stand people who end sentences with "you know." You know what I mean? Thank you very much.
Okay, thanks, Mary.
Bye.
We're speaking about the English language and words and their evolution with Ammon Shea. He's the author of Bad English, A History of Linguistic Aggravation. And actually, we have somebody who wants to talk about aggravate, and we will talk about that when we come back from our break. Stay with us. Welcome back to Topical Currents, on WLRN, Bonnie Berman with Ammon Shea, the author of Reading the OED, One Man, One Year, 21,730 pages, among other books. And we're discussing his latest book, Bad English, A History of Linguistic Aggravation. Before I get to my question, let's go to Maxine, who wants to talk about aggravate.
Okay.
There we go, Maxine. What's aggravating you? Okay.
It's just, I don't understand. It doesn't even make sense when it comes out of people's mouths to say, I'm so aggravated. And I just looked it up just to make sure that I wasn't making myself look dumb on the radio. And it does say to make a situation worse. So I just, I don't understand. And it's just, I think it's gone so long without anyone correcting it that it's just become like a staple.
Okay, well, let me ask you a couple of quick questions. Would you say that this irritates you?
Yes.
Would you say that it exasperates you?
Yeah.
Okay, that's perfect illustration. The problem that we have here is that aggravate is properly thought to mean as a kind of a medical term to make something worse rather than just to annoy somebody. However, there are several problems with holding on to this position, if I might use you as an example here. The first problem is that the original meaning of aggravate as a verb was to make something heavier, because it comes from the Latin root aggravare, meaning to weigh down. The first use of aggravate in English, period, was as an adjective, and it meant threatened with excommunication from the church. So right off the bat, we see that aggravate has had a kind of variety of meanings over the years. Meant to make things worse since the middle of the 16th century, but it did have these other meanings before that. It has been used to mean to annoy somebody for several hundred years. The way in which I want to, I hope not unkindly, make an example of you is that exasperate initially meant to make things worse, just like aggravate was thought to have. Irritate was originally used to mean to rouse somebody to action rather than to annoy somebody. So it's very hard to find a word that has held one meaning for and one meaning only for hundreds of years. It's just not in the nature of language. Words change, and there are very, very few words which have a single, well-defined meaning that stays the same. Aggravate is not at all unusual in this sense. So all the things that we would substitute for aggravate, in many cases, not all of them, but in many cases, words like irritate or even annoy or exasperate or bug, they also had meanings before the meaning of annoyance or things like that. So I think that in certain contexts, you can say aggravate will be used in this way. In another context, I think it is clear in most cases. I think that you are showing that you understand what people mean because you think that they're using it wrong. So you understand that they're using it to mean something that you might not agree with it, but you understand what they are using it to mean.
Right, yeah.
Okay, Maxine?
Yeah, thank you.
Okay, don't be aggravated anymore.
I'll try.
Okay, thanks.
Bye.
Thanks. I want to get to this because this one really took me by surprise. Tech speak. So OMG, which of course, you know, is constantly disparaged, you know, by those who want to save our language, actually goes back to the beginning of the 20th century. Tell us about that.
Yeah, it's there's one of my favorite parts of the Oxford English Dictionary, and this is a recent thing that part of the recent edit that they've been doing on the Oxford English Dictionary. They found the earliest citation for OMG currently is from 1917, and it is in the form of a letter that was written by John Fisher, who is the Lord of the British Navy. He was the Lord Admiral of the British Navy. So hardly a vapid school child. He was, you know, one of the most powerful men in Britain at the time. And he was writing a letter to Winston Churchill. And it's very clear what he's saying. The letter is, I hear that a new order of knighthood is on the tapis, OMG. And then in parens, he actually writes, oh, my God. And shower it on the Admiralty. This is, you know, a very, very powerful, well-educated man in, you know, one of the high points of British history, writing to another obviously very well-educated, you know, very powerful man. So these words tend to pop up in places that we might not expect. Other words like LOL. LOL is a little more recent. I think the earliest evidence so far is from 1989. But many of these little kind of abbreviated forms are quite a bit older than we think. Something else that I found that I really thought delightful was that there are a number of English textbooks in the beginning of the 20th century, particularly those that were aimed at the middle class, for kids when they're going into business school or things like that, that they would specifically teach children how to write in abbreviated forms, specifically when they were sending telegraphs. So the language used to write telegraphs was actually strikingly similar to the language used to send text, except that one was considered proper business practice and the other one is, for some other reason, considered today to be strikingly inappropriate. But when you get down to it, really, we were teaching teenagers how to write text speak 100 years ago. And it's a lot of the abbreviations that were used back then are still in play today.
All right. I have some news for you, Ammon. Or at least, at least Tim does in Fort Lauderdale. Go ahead, Tim. Spill the beans.
Mr. Shea, in the course of your conversation in the last section, and it's in the course of conversation, you are not trying to answer someone's question. You split an infinitive by saying to not be. Is that okay these days?
Splitting an infinitive is a... okay. Well, I always like to... I try to quote Raymond Chandler on splitting the infinitive, which is he wrote a wonderful letter to Edward Meeks back in 1947, and Edward Meeks had corrected his text. He was an editor, I think, and he took out a split infinitive, and Chandler wrote back and said, "When I split an infinitive, goddammit, I split it so it will remain split." He had very firm feelings on this. Well, look at it this way. Infinitives have been getting split now for about 800 years. They've been split since the 13th century. And before that, people did not split infinitives because it was not possible. English was a highly inflected language, and so there was no use of the word to before the verb. The verb just had a specific ending put onto it, depending on what function it had in the sentence. But Chaucer split his infinitives, and so did John Tyndale in writing his Bible. So it was common, or not common, it was not uncommon, I would say, to use a double negative that I think serves a certain purpose there. And then they disappeared for about 400 years, from about 1400 until 1800. There are almost no instances of the split infinitive. And then they reappeared at the beginning of the 19th century and spread like wildfire. And nobody is entirely certain why any of these things happened. However, there is no actual reason to not split infinitives. The reason that is given is that right. I will admit, I split them. I have had a number of linguists with whom I have corresponded say, you know, you really split your infinitives quite aggressively. It's not intentional, I think, but it is a habit that I've picked up. The reason that is given for not splitting your infinitive is that it violates the rules of Latin, essentially. But English is not a Latinate language. We're not a Romance language. We're a Germanic language. There's no reason for us to be unduly bound by Latinate rules. And on top of that, most linguists don't really think that you are splitting an infinitive. To be is actually not the verb. The verb is be. To is an additional word. So putting a word between to and be is not actually splitting the infinitive. That's what we generally think of as the split infinitive when we talk about this. But I don't think that there is any reason to abide by that rule. I'm entirely comfortable myself. And if people choose to not do it, I think that that is fine. But I can see some ways in which it might create a problem.
Okay, Tim.
You have just managed to put my mind at ease about it from now on.
Okay, glad to hear it.
Thank you very much.
Okay, thanks so much.
Bye-bye.
I'm so sorry that we're coming to the end of the program. I wish we had longer because we have so many more callers and emailers, and it's so much fun to kind of parse our language. But before we go, Ammon, I really loved your quiz where we had to decide who wrote it, Shakespeare or a rapper, of all things, two disparate worlds colliding, one would think. So can I give you a couple of these now before we go?
Absolutely.
Okay. Who wrote this, Shakespeare or a modern-day rapper? But if you don't, I'll unsheath my Excalibur like a noble knight.
That is, I believe, rapper. That is Gangstar.
Gangstar rapper. And sounds a lot like Shakespeare. Okay. Never name her child if she be a whore.
Yeah, that is Shakespeare from The Merry Wives of Windsor.
Sabotaged, shell-shocked, rocked and ruled, day in the life of a fool.
Public enemy. Brothers gonna work it out.
Okay. Now the tables turn, but I remember they used to clown me.
That's Mac 10 and Gerald Levert. Money's just a touch away.
You're good. Okay. And we don't have time for more. I'm so sorry. I really thought this was great fun, Ammon Shea.
Fine line between Shakespeare and gangster rap.
That's the point. Ammon Shea is an author of several books, including Reading the OED. He's a dictionary collector. He's been the consulting editor of American Dictionaries. He's contributed to the On Language column in Sunday's New York Times and has reviewed language books for the New York Times Book Review. And we've been talking about his latest book, Bad English, A History of Linguistic Aggravation. And it's a great read. Thanks so much, Ammon Shea.
Thanks so much for having me.
It's been our pleasure. And that is our program for today. Thank you for joining us. Our producer is Richard Ives with technical direction from our online producer, Paul Leary. Free audio archives and downloads at our website, WLRN.org, and at our Facebook page, facebook.com/topicalcurrents. On tomorrow's Topical Currents, literary contributor Ariel Gonzalez speaks with Rebecca Miller, and Linda Gassenheimer speaks with event planner Barton G. Bonnie Berman joining you in sending best wishes to Joseph Cooper for his speedy recovery and hoping your day is a great one. Please stay tuned for Here and Now.